Well, hello, Little Saigon, Seattle. It is February the 24th, 2020, and this is your good friend Dan with the Little Saigon Report. And I am honored to have with me today Mr. Adam Kokesh. For those of you who don't know, Adam Kokesh has been an anti-war activist for many years. He served in uniform in combat. He is a person who would identify himself as a voluntarist or an agorist or maybe even an anarchist, but technically he's running for the libertarian candidacy for the presidency of the United States right now. And he had some time to talk to me today, and I'd just like to say, hey, thanks, Adam, for coming on, and how's the campaign going?
Hey Dan, that's been amazing. We are on the bus right now, No Force One, on our way from Orlando back to Dallas before heading on to Oklahoma City and then Alabama and Iowa for their state conventions this weekend. We're about a third of the way through the delegate selection part of the primary process for the Libertarian Party. And it's just been amazing. I love this. And if you're going to introduce me as a presidential candidate, I've got to put some serious disclaimers on that because every time I have to introduce myself as a presidential candidate, I throw up in my mouth a little bit because you really have to be some kind of psycho to want to be president of the United States, to wield this unjust power that shouldn't exist in the first place over other human beings. And my platform is fundamentally different because I am not running to be president. I am technically running for president, but it's more accurate to say that what I'm doing is turning the federal election into a referendum on whether or not the federal government should be allowed to exist at all. And when elected, I am going to be president only long enough to pardon everyone who I possibly can in federal prison for victimless crimes, especially whistleblowers, and then resign it with an executive order that declares the federal government bankrupt. And I become custodian of the federal government, which is an appropriate term for a lot of reasons. And then we take it through, excuse me, a peaceful, orderly, responsible bankruptcy process that leaves us with 50 independent states and up to 562 sovereign native nations as the first step in the process of localization. And that's getting government down local to the community level. Because a community is a voluntary association. It's something that you choose to be a part of. You can choose to leave at any time. And this really is an important evolution of my own messaging and understanding of freedom and libertarianism, because for so many years, I was sucked into playing their game of, well, we have to have a centralized solution and we have to argue issues and policy and statistics. And it's like, no, none of that. And the libertarian message shouldn't be anything about issues or the way that the old parties talk about politics. But no, you can have as much or as little government as you want, as long as it's voluntary, as long as you don't force it on anybody, you're not holding anybody captive in your community or your system. And that's really what should be uniting people. And it is already this platform is bringing people together from all sorts of different political ideologies who say, I just want the freedom to live how I want in my community with systems based on my values to meet my needs. I don't need to force it on other people. I don't need a centralized plan. I'm okay with getting what I want ethically. And now we can stop arguing over aesthetics. How do we want our communities to look? How do we want where we live to be organized? And say, let's talk about ethics. If you're going to have that, that's fine. You can have whatever you want over there, and other people can have what they want in their communities, as long as you're all going about getting it ethically.
I mean, that sounds, I think, something I would agree with. I have to be honest with you. I didn't vote in 2016. Up until that election, I would have called myself a libertarian. And then I heard Gary Johnson say famously, "Bake the cake." And listen, I'm not a homophobe. I'm not opposed to what people do privately in their own. In fact, listen, do you want to see me having sex in public? No, I don't want to see other people having sex. You know what I mean? But what people do privately is their own business, right? And when he did that, it was like, holy fuck. And I swear, just so you know, it's okay to swear on the Little Saigon Report.
My little virgin ears won't be offended, don't worry.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's like, that was, to me, it's like I describe it like being on a train. A long time ago when I was a teenager back in the 80s, I would have called myself, because I would watch, you know, This Week with David Brinkley with my dad, I would have called myself a George F. Will Republican, a small government Republican. Talk about impossible things that have never existed.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah,
never.
Absolutely.
And then,
that's a really important historic point.
Yeah. And then libertarian, and then it's like now I'm where I'm at. I'm basically an anarchist. And I figure I'd been one my whole life. And, you know, from talking to you, it seems like you went through a kind of migration philosophically. Is that fair?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But I want to challenge you on something here. And it's not just the semantics, because I went through a period, and I assume you've read some Rothbard as well as some Kokesh.
Yeah, I've read some Rothbard.
Okay. So Ethics of Liberty, his book, was the one that got me to the bottom of the rabbit hole, so to speak. But the term that he came up with to describe what he was talking about, which was the ethical philosophy of voluntarism primarily that I subscribe to, the term took not only the two worst possible words to describe what he was talking about, anarchy and capitalism, and combined them into one term guaranteed to offend everyone.
Is it catalaxy? Is that it? Or is that someone else? Catalaxy?
What? Catalaxy.
Have you ever heard of that term, catalaxy?
No.
Okay.
Oh, catalaxy with an XY at the end. Yeah. But
yeah.
Hold on. Let me just finish this point, though, about the terminology, because I want to bring it back to the concept of anarchy. And this is really important as a distinction, because what Rothbard is describing is this ethical philosophy of libertarianism. And anarchy, if you define it very, very narrowly based on the root of the word, no rulers, and then you impose your own concept of what it means to rule someone through government or force or whatever on you, then you go, okay, well, everybody's an anarchist. Nobody wants to be ruled. Everybody has a free will. They want it to be respected. But even in political terms, that's not what anarchy means. And I don't mean the general use of the term to slander, you know, rulerlessness as chaotic, and the definition of anarchy as chaos, I think is a deliberate misdefinition of the word for propaganda purposes.
Absolutely.
But even if you just define anarchy as statelessness or a society with no government or the ideal of no government, it's really missing the point of what at least voluntarism, ethics, anarchy in that sense is supposed to be about. Because honestly, I want to challenge you here for a second, Dan. If you describe yourself as an anarchist, as a sort of libertarian anarchist, because you believe in the ethical foundation that I believe in, that you would have no problem with people coming together and forming something voluntarily and calling it government. At that point, you don't go up to them with a gun to their head and say, you can't call that government because we define government as something that is coercive and violent, and you're doing it nonviolently, so you have to call that a homeowners association or a club or some other word. You can't. No, it's fine. Let them call it that, and it still is government to them, to people who want to be governed. They may be only accepting a voluntary system, but it still is a system of governing. We would all look at it institutionally and say, yeah, okay, that's categorically, yeah, it's not violent, it's not coercive like we know government today. But yeah, that's a government. And in that sense, we're not anarchists if we allow for that ethical possibility of people creating government systems ethically. Then I think the term fails us at that point. Same thing with capitalism. You know, anarchy capitalism, anarcho-capitalism is a term. Rothbard wasn't describing what he was talking about. His philosophy, I think, humbly, is better described as voluntarism. Anarchy and capitalism are two possible outcomes from applying ethics to politics. But let's not focus on outcomes. Let's focus on process. Let's focus on ethics. Let's focus on principle. Focus on that transformation of government to an ethical system through localization, through customization of the government experience, through this everybody gets what they want strategy. I guarantee you're going to be better at communicating these ideas because now you're actually communicating them more accurately.
Right. And I have to say, when I tend to discuss this, I don't tend to get obsessed with words. I focus more on concepts. but I do understand what you're saying. So I tend to agree with what you just said. I use the word anarchist as a word that means essentially what you said, but I also realize that the state and a lot of other people use that word as a dirty word, and they do equate it to chaos. I do not. I personally would like to take that word back. On the other hand, I do see your point.
Yeah, this now we're getting a little bit, it's not so much into the weeds, but a little inside baseball of messaging strategy.
Sure.
But it is really important that our message reflects what we're about. And we're about love and peace and respect and nonviolence. You know, these are really critical things. And we can create our own intellectual concept of anarchy as a peaceful, harmonious, nonviolent world. But hey, if you're going to talk to somebody in France, don't start yelling English at them and just raise your voice louder when they don't understand you because you don't speak French. If you're there, speak the language that they're used to hearing that's going to be effective in communicating these ideas to them. So I really want to get to, you know, again, presenting localization as the everybody gets what they want strategy, getting back in touch with what it means to have a message that is founded on love and respect for your fellow human beings. Let's communicate that effectively. And I think, right, you know, the use of the word anarchy to describe this is, do you know the concept of the libertarian macho flash?
I've not heard of that before.
Okay, so this was kind of more of a thing in the 80s and 90s with the Libertarian Party and early 2000s when I was getting involved. And when you wake up, I got to sort of back up to explain the personal, emotional, and psychological dynamics here. But let me ask you, Dan, how long have you considered yourself woke to the nature of government, at least?
I would say it's been periodic waking going back to when I was in kindergarten. It's just okay. That it's like I periodically go back to sleep, and it is a ratcheting up.
When did it sort of crystallize as a worldview for you?
2016, but almost in 1999 when I got out of the Army. Like when I got out of the Army.
Go ahead. Sorry, you're making my point for me just perfectly.
Well, I wasn't trying to make your point, Mr. Kokesh, president to be elected. when I got out of the Army in 99, I was very disillusioned. And just so you know, I was never in combat. I guess the closest I ever came to angry people would have been my year I spent in Korea. But when I got back, when I got out of the service, I just was very disillusioned. And at that time, I started reading lots of Noam Chomsky. And even though I would not call myself, I like how you're going here, just so you know. You and I agree. It's just maybe a language thing that I'm screwing up on here. But he was very much kind of a syndicalist, and sometimes he'd call himself a libertarian socialist. But with respect to his critique of media and with respect to his general critique of the system, I am still a big fan of Noam Chomsky to this day. I would say 99 was when it first sort of hit me big. The problem is I also kind of fell in love in 2000. And the thing is, when you fall in love with someone that believes in voting and believes in the state and believes, even if you vote my ex-wife would have preferred I voted Republican than not vote. She was a Democrat and more or less a socialist. She would have rather seen me vote for George Bush than not vote.
A Republican socialist.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
All right. So no, here's where I'm going with this is that if you wake up today, the people who are coming into our movement today are immediately part of a global community that is very easy to connect with online. When you got to that phase of waking up, getting out of the army in 99, the internet was there, but it wasn't really a thing. You know, this is we kind of take it for granted having the truth button one click away, having this incredible ability to connect with other people in communities and forums, and to feel like you're not alone. And if you started waking up or got into this process pre-internet, if you're, you know, in the 80s and, you know, Ethics of Liberty lands on your desk and you read the book, you go, okay, where did this book come from? Am I the only one who understands this? Why is everybody still acting like a zombie? Oh, crap, I'm alone. Wow, like, that it is a radically different experience to wake up to libertarianism today than pre-internet, you know, depending on where you want to make that cutoff. But certainly 1999 the internet was nowhere near what it is today as a functional hive mind and resource in so many ways. And so people of that era, when, you know, struggled with it psychologically, emotionally, like, hey, I'm going away from the herd on this one. You know, I'm stepping out into the refreshing cold air of freedom from the stifling, comfortable, smothering smoke of statism. And that transformation for an individual is really affected by how they're received. Does your family say, oh my gosh, you're freaking crazy, I'd rather have you vote Republican than not vote? You know, like, do your friends and coworkers disown you? Or, you know, and to an extent, you know that they all will, at least at first, have some kind of negative reaction, the same way that you in your own transformation had some negative response to, oh crap, I've been wrong my whole life about these important things, and I've been going along with a system that hurts people unnecessarily. Like, that's a tough realization. So back to this idea of the libertarian macho flash, in those pre-internet days, a lot of the people who embrace libertarianism and really understand it also carried a certain insecurity about it. And it was like, well, I'm going to come out the other side. It's kind of like coming out of the closet. I mean, it really is like being, and obviously, you know, there were never really, you know, lynchings of people for being libertarian, although arguably throughout history, it's anybody who challenges authority gets beaten down or the guillotine or whatever the case may be. But it has some very similar recent, you know, history dynamics to what it means to come out of the closet as a gay person, to come out of the closet as a libertarian and say, yeah, I'm not okay with this. I'm not part of the mainstream. I'm not okay with the system. I'm not okay with just going along with these injustices. I at least want to understand it differently. I'm probably going to want to do something about it and call it out. But then imagine you're surrounded by people who say that you're crazy and you don't have an online community to go to. So some people went to, well, I'm so libertarian, I don't just want pot to be legal. I think all drugs should be legal. I think kids should be allowed to do whatever they want, and militaries and governments shouldn't exist. And it's this, you get the idea, right? Now, the libertarian macho flash. And I think the modern version of the libertarian macho flash is, I'm so libertarian that I'm anarchist. And it's like, no,
Can I stop you there? I do respect you, sir, and I think I actually could see myself voting for you if I voted at all. But I'm not really doing exactly what you said. I mean, I hear what you're saying, like that perspective, but that's not.
I'm not saying that you are. But because of that dynamic, a lot of people have embraced anarchism as a, you know, anarcho-capitalism as a way of representing libertarianism.
Right.
And I think it's based on, I think as we develop, I also think it's, if you're the powers that be and you go, oh wow, people are really waking up to libertarianism, well, how do we divide this movement? Well, let's divide it between anarchists and minarchists and create this, you know, bullshit, artificial, false divide. And let's push anarchists out of society. Hey, if we can keep them from voting, if we can convince them that voting is violence, if we can convince them that not participating is the best way to change the system, then hey, we get to keep the system going longer. And I think that's right. The real danger. I think that's, like I said, in light of the modern dynamics of the internet in waking up, I think things have transformed a lot. And I think we're overcoming this in so many ways. I don't want to see people give in to that emotional indulgence. I want to see us become a mature movement of the adults in the room. That's who we are. Let's be cool, calm, and collected. Talk to people with easy to understand language that resonates with them where they're at, that addresses their concerns, that gives them what they want, and recognize that most human beings are followers. And even in our own lives, you know, like I think I'm an alpha. I'm in charge of my own life. Well, when I really break it down, like, you know, when it comes to fashion and design, I'm a follower. You know, I don't care about those things. I'm willing to defer to the judgments of experts. When it comes to vehicle design or, you know, so many other aspects of our life that we have intense specialization of labor and with technology, like, I'm a follower. So let's be leaders in politics. Let's be leaders in social organization. And that means stepping up to talk to people about what we care about, being involved in your community, running for office as a libertarian, being an engaged activist. It's not enough to say, well, I understand there's injustice in the world, so I'm going to sit back and have freedom for myself. No, let's provide value based on our knowledge and insight and understanding. Let's provide value to our fellow human beings and stop the suffering of statism as best we can.
I think that sounds great. I mean, I totally am on board with it. Have you ever heard of the concept of a caged Calvinist?
Oh, maybe from college, man.
Yeah, it's an old-timey thing, so it's okay if you've never heard of it. Basically, it's a lot like, it may not be your macho flash, but essentially during the Protestant Reformation, there would be people that would become Protestants who would kind of go off the deep end, like become super zealots. And be like, nobody's as Protestant as I'm Protestant. So mm-hmm. The Calvinists would put you in a cage if that was the case. They wouldn't kill you. They would put you in a cage for 6 or 7 months until you could be let out. Now, I'm not proposing we do something like that. But the thing is, that's not an uncommon reaction to the breakdown of cognitive dissonance. Like when cognitive dissonance breaks down, it usually does result in a very kind of, I'm not going to say terrible, but predictable sets of emotional responses.
Yes.
And I think that one of the things we probably dismiss, and we shouldn't dismiss, is that when you say we need to get out there and talk to people, which I totally, this is why I do my podcast, well, one of the reasons is to do this. But at the same time, it is like walking through a minefield, because you're dealing with a lot of people who have been educated by the public schools to basically be children.
Yep.
And so you're talking about managing children, to be honest with you.
Well, hold on. I understand that, but I'm going to go back to my economic specialization of labor analogy here, right? If we believe in specialization of labor, we must also believe in specialization of labor in leadership. And I know, man, this is a really corny pop culture reference, but have you seen the movie The Devil Wears Prada?
No, that's one I've never seen.
Okay, so it's a chick flick, high fashion movie.
That's why I've never seen it.
Yeah.
That's why I've never seen it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. I'm kind of embarrassed to be making the point this way. But there's one point where Anna Wintour, I think is her name, and she's the editor in chief of Vogue or some other major fashion magazine. I don't even. I see. This is not my wheelhouse for certain. But that's exactly why this is an important point. Is that she's looking at an intern saying, what color is that sweater you're wearing? Oh, it's blue. She goes, no, it's this specific kind of blue, because 3 years ago in our fashion runway, whatever, we determined now you got it off the rack at Ross and, you know, da da da. And for her, if you look at, you know, Ann Winters, this goddess of the American fashion world, she might look at her job as, we're shuffling children around, or we're the ones dressing our children, teaching our kids how to look good. And we're the ones determining fashion for America for people who aren't even thinking about it.
So, can I pause you for a second on that point? Is that okay?
Sure.
So, and it'll allow you to continue, but just to circle this back to the whole question of your platform and your campaign, because mm-hmm. your platform, mm-hmm. if I may summarize, is the graceful, nonviolent, managed going out of business of the federal government, mm-hmm. so to speak. Is that
true? Yep. Yep.
And so what you're talking about here is, and I think what you're talking about here is the type of psychological perspective you should have if you're going to want to make that happen. I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's just, hey, look, guys, you don't want to think about this. It's fine. You know, politics sucks. I get it. Yeah. Especially right now, we're so polarized. You know, and localization is the cure for polarization. I don't have to convince you now, as the average American voter, to read Rothbard, to read my book. No, hey, look, vote for me to localize the federal government, and right away, you get more of what you want in your state. We're not going to pull the rug out from underneath anyone. We're going to have a peaceful transition. I like that you inserted the word graceful there. I would certainly call what we're doing a graceful version of the collapse that we're avoiding by doing it this way. You know, let's do it the easy way instead of the hard way. And I take a little bit of offense, Dan, to you saying, you know, let's look at other people as children. No. Let's look at them as customers, the way we want to be treated as customers.
Listen,
in every other aspect of our lives.
I mean, when I say children, maybe that's a little bit mean, but I got to say, I live in Seattle, dude. And I have had every kind. Can I give you an example? I'll give you an example. In 2013, when I called myself a libertarian who was not opposed to people who called themselves anarchists, I went to meetings and there would be anarchists who say, "How can you be a minarchist? Blah blah blah," and they'd be like, "Wait a minute, what are you doing? Well, you're not pure enough. You're not real enough. You should be a total criminal, a total outcast, totally on the margins." If you really believe in freedom, if you really believe in liberty, you should distance yourself completely from that.
The anarchist-minarchist division is the dumbest, most bullshit nonsense in our movement.
It's a false dichotomy. Isn't it a false dichotomy?
Absolutely. First of all, because, again, like I said, if you're an anarchist in a libertarian property rights, freedom of speech sense, you wouldn't tell people you can't form a voluntary government. But I will say that, you know, it's the same thing with minarchists. If you say, well, my goal for minarchy is to get government down to something that's voluntary, you know, it kind of makes both terms, anarchist and minarchist, in the libertarian context, totally meaningless. Because if you're a minarchist whose goal is voluntarism, you wouldn't say, well, yeah, as an individual, you don't have the right to secede on your own property. Yeah, of course you do. Yeah, this country was founded on declaring your independence, on seceding from empire. Of course you have that right. And yeah, of course government should be voluntary. I think where we both fail, as anarchists or minarchists, or where both segments fail, is, you know, when it comes to creating consistent policy based on these ethical principles. And when, you know, part of my own intellectual process is been discovering these connections and saying, oh yeah, there, we can think ourselves out of these problems. We can resolve these contradictions. You know, that's how I became a libertarian in the first place, seeing all the contradictions of government and saying, I don't know. I can't just say, well, people are getting hurt and it doesn't make sense and I'm going to go on with my life. No, I have to figure this out. I have to do something about it. And I think when the more we allow ourselves to be divided, the less effective we are. You know, if we don't hang together, we hang separately.
I think that's a good point. And, you know, it's funny. I had a graduate advisor when I was studying history a long time ago. And his belief was that no society, and when I say society, I mean society with a government, no society could be successful above 250,000 people. Like he picked that number. He said 250,000. That's the max. You go above that max, you will never make a functioning society, ever. And arbitrary number, but he had a reason for this. You know, his reason, looking at history and city-states versus nations versus empires, and his view was city-states have a track record of some sustainability. Everything else tends to just fall on its face over time.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a very good point. And I wouldn't say... I wouldn't really argue with that point. I would try to refine it in the sense that, you know, maybe even 250,000 is too high when you talk about a localized concept of a community or a geographically based governing unit. But I wouldn't even try to put a number on it. What I would say is that government fails anytime it gets bigger than a community. And a community, if you feel if you're such a lone wolf kind of dude, you're a community of one. Well, if you're forced into a system with two people, it's going to fail because you're going to be pissed off. You're not going to be happy with that. If you have a governing system for a city state or a county or something that has a natural geographic identity as a community, I think that could work. And I think that's where, your professor there was correct in sort of historically saying, well, somewhere around 250,000, but it really depends on the individuals, the culture, the economy of those circumstances to say what is something that can create a governing system that works. And I think you and I would both say, well, any system at all is going to work better when it's nonviolent and cooperative rather than violent and coercive. Where is it realistic that a government can be a system that is nonviolent and cooperative, well, it really has to be a community level thing. And if it's going to be geographically based, you know, it has to have, you know, you have to have the ability to leave, to break off, to say, you know what, I'm not going to be a part of this system anymore. And then it's an ethical system and it's sustainable. So just to bring it back to the present tense in terms of how we apply this idea to understanding where do we go from here, I think that, you know, for using me as an example, when I say that, you know, when you're that lone wolf, you know, dude who's got to be left alone, I own 10 acres in the middle of nowhere in the mountains in Arizona, and I'm building a fully off-grid homestead. And geographically, I have a great community of people who live that homestead lifestyle and more or less want to be left alone and have a community network where there's no, you know, nothing that we would even call a government. We have a roads association in our neighborhood where, you know, we all chip in a little bit and get the roads.
A roads association? Yeah. You're going to build the roads, Adam?
Yeah. Well, no, hold on. It gets better than that, Dan. When I bought my land, it didn't connect to any of the existing roads.
That sounds perfect.
So you know what I did, right? You know
what
I did?
That's perfect. Why would you need a road at that point? A road is only a problem then, isn't it?
Yeah, well, no. You know what I did?
What?
I built a road.
You did.
Without any government. So when people ask you, hey, who's going to build the road without the government? You can just be like, hey, that guy, Adam Kokesh, he's going to build the roads.
Wait a minute, Mr. Kokesh, are you saying that you built a road without forming a road army or a road government or having road taxes or breaking into people's homes to make sure they're not lying to you about the road money? Are you saying you did that without any of that crap?
Yep, it's possible, believe it or not. You can have roads without hurting people to make them. It's amazing what you can do when you embrace ethics. Yeah, so I want to be, you know, in that geographic sense, relatively left alone. But I think it's kind of a mispresentation of libertarianism when we say, well, we're the ones who just want to be left alone. It's like, no, I don't want to be left alone. I want to be engaged in a beautiful, harmonious society and culture of a global human family. You know, I want health insurance. You know, I want police services, you know, public safety services. I want security services. I want these fundamental things that you know, people expect from government. But I think we can do them in decentralized networks. I want money. I want money that works. I want money that gains value instead of loses value through inflation. Hey, well, we have Bitcoin. You know, I don't need government fiat currency anymore to get that. And I think the more and more that people understand that, the sooner we'll get to that. And I just wanted to point out that this idea that you get to of, you know, 250,000 being the largest a community can be.
No, that was his number. Listen, Adam.
Right. So you see how I built on that concept. Yeah, I think you would agree that my, you know, taking that concept and developing it more precisely, you know, as I just did, is kind of agreeing with the fundamental point, but putting a much better currently relevant understanding on it.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree. And I think what I would say is I really like this particular professor. He's a good guy, but even he probably didn't see the full picture. Like from his perspective, it was almost just a numbers problem. It really wasn't just a numbers problem, but that's the way he defined it.
Yeah.
So let me ask you another question. So you draw a delineation. When you win election, right? When you win election and you're sworn in as president of the United States, you draw a delineation between those parts of the federal government that you will more or less immediately shutter and those parts of the federal government that you will sort of manage through a process of dispersal to the states. Is that a fair representation?
Yes. So the concept of the bankruptcy is that I have a fiduciary responsibility to pay back the American people as well. And that's one of the things I really don't get to talk about enough. That I appreciate so much about this, but the basic principles in localization dictate to me that in this process, every federal agency has to go through one of three or a combination of these three processes. And one is localization, really easy, like Federal Department of Transportation. It's providing a legitimate service. People legitimately want it. The delivery of that service is not an ethics violation. Okay, cool. We cut it up into 50 apportioned pieces. Every state or now sovereign native nation gets their share of their resources, the authority over what's in their territory. Boom, done, easy, right? Then the next one is just dissolution, liquidation. The IRS, for example, so if it's unethical or if it's redundant, then that's what happens to it. So the IRS, you know, every state has their own tax agencies. We don't need to give them IRS resources to be able to function that way. So the IRS, boom, done. Department of Education, boom, done. Department of Energy. Now, again, to do this in a responsible way, and I could go into all the details here because I'm a real policy nerd. I love this stuff, and I could pick apart every little detail of this. I have gone through the federal org chart. I know.
Well, can I pause? Hey, Mr. Wonk, sure. Mr. W-O-N-K, right? Mr. Wonk, can I ask you a specific question then? With respect to the Department of Energy, because I know something about the DOE. Listen, we have something called the Hanford Reservation in Washington State, managed by like many, many corporations. Lots of toxic waste, lots of crap that's leaking into the Columbia. Mm-hmm. How are you going to manage the dissolution of atomic resources within the Department of Energy?
Oh, that's a great one. And you know, people more, you know, don't recognize
that. Also, I'm hearing some ripping on your side. I just want to double check. Is there something ripping over there or something ruffling? I just want to double check.
No, there was a gust of rain earlier.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like I was telling you, it's raining pretty hard, kind of on and off here in Pensacola today. We're on our way back from the Libertarian Party of Florida.
Hey, and I want to talk about that next. I'm sorry, I do want to talk about the debate because the audio was terrible. What I found on YouTube.
Oh no, that was just the immediate live stream that you saw. There is a professional version coming. So yeah. It's,
okay. So how are you going to manage?
There's been a lot of interesting stuff with the
How are you going to manage? There's lots of very dangerous atomic materials within the DOE. How are you going to manage that?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is, you know, people ask this question is in terms of the nuclear arsenal, and it in that sense it's really simple. So let me go back to the process, and I'll try to bring it around to the Department of Energy DOE. And the nuclear issue specifically. So we've got localize, liquidate, or spin off. And I I'll come back to spinning off because it's important in the dissolution process. But in terms of the military, what's going to happen to the military is a combination of liquidation and localization. So getting in line with the founder's vision of a decentralized militia-based defense, the technologies and resources and units and personnel that serve legitimate defensive purposes, small arms, tanks, anti-aircraft, things like that, those get apportioned among the states. Things that have no legitimate defensive purpose, nuclear weapons, long-range bombers, drones, nuclear submarines, aircraft carriers, things like that, and the entire nuclear arsenal, of course, get de-weaponized and liquidated. And that's part of the process of liquidating those assets that should not be apportioned to the states, but really can only be claimed by the American people directly. So this is a significant industrial process, and for the Department of Energy as well, for all of its various resources, when it comes to nuclear weapons, they get de-weaponized and to the point where the raw components of those resources can then be auctioned off for industrial purposes. And I would say the same thing with the Department of Education, or excuse me, Department of Energy, with its resources. But it is, of course, a largely regulatory agency that really doesn't need to exist, that is just part of the American federal government's corporatism mechanism of managing corporations and maintaining their power that they wouldn't have in a free market.
Gotcha. So here's another question for you, and I don't need to talk about the debate thing because really that explains it. The online YouTube one that I saw was terrible, but you're saying there's one that's higher quality out there
as
far as the video and the audio.
Yes.
Okay,
well,
cool.
It's coming. So I mean, this is Remember, when you're talking about the old parties, the Democrats and Republicans, the status monstrosities that they are, they have the mainstream media on their side. And a big part of that is making them look important, making them look professional, and having these super highly produced live debates. For the Libertarian Party, we're kind of doing it all on our own.
Yeah, and, but I gotta call you out on something. If you're going to be, and I respect you for this, but if you're going to be one of these optimistic, hey, technology has been so awesome people, you really can't play the, well, we didn't have the resources to make the thing work out. Because, dude,
I'm not saying that. I'm saying we don't have the resources to broadcast live on cable TV with, millions of dollars behind our production.
That's
what
true.
We do have, what you saw, like I said, what you saw was someone in the audience, actually from my team, with their cell phone making a live stream of that debate. And it is really not fair, Dan, for you to judge our production values as a whole based on, if someone went to the Democrat debates and in the theater live streamed from their cell phone, you wouldn't say, oh man, their production value sucks.
You'd actually say, I would. I mean, here's the thing. I'm not beating up on the guy. No, Mr. Kokesh, I'm not beating up on the person. I'm trying to point out that people will say to me, technology has never been more empowering with respect to ease, cost, access. So I would have not used my mobile device. Oh, by the way, I know enough. I mean, I'm a computer programmer, so I know enough about how those things work.
Because we didn't have a live professional production. We had a professional recording.
Okay, so fair. That clears it up. Listen, that clears it up. Mr. Kokesh, that totally clears it up. Right. I apologize. I retract my negative thing I said.
But your statement is it's still relevant and appropriate to say, like, hey, why don't we have this? And the resources that come into the Libertarian Party are, like a few million dollars a year, tops. When you go look at the Democrats and Republicans, it's billions. Yeah, billions. And you add in tax, super PACs and campaigns. Yes, you're right. It's in the billions. We don't get to do what they do. We don't get to go to a corporation and say, hey, why don't you host a fundraiser for us where 30 of your top executives all write me a $2,800 max donation check because I'm going to enact policy that's going to, favor your corporation. We don't get to do that as libertarians, so we're kind of at a severe financial disadvantage that we choose to embrace because we're not bribable that way.
Fair. No, that's fair, and I kind of think that's the good way to deal with that. With respect to the military, and I would say the military and various organizations around the donut around Washington, D.C., so I'm going to include the military, and I'm going to include government unions.
CIA.
I'm about to talk about the people that I just don't know how to say this. They might not be that easy to convince. How are you going to deal with those people? And that's a nice way of putting it. I don't think they're going to be easy to convince. And frankly, I think they're going to try to kill you. Like if you won, I'm just going to be honest, they're going to try to kill you.
I certainly understand the risk that I have taken on by what is essentially a treasonous campaign saying that we're going to declare the Constitution illegitimate.
Actually, can I pause you for a second? I disagree with you the word treason. In 1996,
no, by there, just
can I say it? No, I know what you're saying. They'll call you treasonous, but I think it's the opposite. What you're trying to do is the opposite. In 1996, when I took my commission to protect and defend the Constitution, blah, 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 I actually took it seriously. If the officers who were commissioned with me in 1996 took their oath seriously, D.C. would be 6 inches of blood. I'll be honest with you.
Oh, yes. No, I have T-shirts I used to make that say if the troops offended freedom, they'd attack the government. Hey, let me bake your noodle real fast here on something else entirely. Did you know that the Constitution itself is actually unconstitutional?
It's bullshit, dude. Tell me about the Great Memory Hole. It is those years between the end of the war with the Brits in 1783 and the Constitution.
Yes.
It's a memory hole. Nobody likes to talk about the Articles of Confederation. Nobody likes to talk about
exactly.
The fact
well, I love it.
What we need is the Declaration of Independence. That's all we ever needed.
Yes. So under the Articles of Confederation, there was a clause of unanimous consent for any change in the terms of the union. And when they had the Constitutional Convention, as it is referred to now, for the current Constitution, they just changed the rules. I said, well, no, to ratify this, you only need, let's say, 9 out of 13. And it was 9. That was what they went for. And they got, they were able to basically bully the state leaderships, the legislatures in each state to ratify the Constitution. And in some places, actually coerced people into voting for it. So if you're a constitutionalist, you believe that the rule of law is the rule of law and the terms agreed on should be respected, well, then the modern Constitution is already null and void to you. The only legitimate governing document in this territory of the United States is the Articles of Confederation. We are living under the regime of a counter coup right now, or Absolutely. A counter revolution. And, it is one of the great perversions of Americanism that was about, overthrowing empire, standing up for freedom and independence, that has been perverted over history, that we connected that, like that it is written out of that period, as you say, is written out of the history books, where most Americans are deliberately led to forget, because it is the people who are in charge, given authority, or I should say, using the authority as their excuse for using the Constitution as their excuse to do unethical things in the name of authority. They are usurpers of the revolution. They are counter-revolutionaries who created a new unjust authority. And as for my campaign, sometimes I get asked, is this platform unconstitutional? And I say, yes, absolutely. That's kind of the point. We are appealing to the higher authority known as the Declaration of Independence, which says we have not only a right but a duty to alter and abolish systems of government that no longer serve us. I think we're well past that point.
Absolutely. And it's great, because a lot of people don't understand that historical distinction and those historical facts very well. A lot of people will see the Constitution as this thing that was perfect, but the humans were imperfect. But what if it was a combination of the two? And like you said, what if it was crooked from the get-go?
Yeah.
It was crooked to begin with.
Yeah, and a lot of people are starting to wake up too to the connection of militarism and central banking, and huge thanks to Ron Paul. I love especially his quote. It's no coincidence that the century of total war coincided with the century of central banking, and that the curse of Hamilton was that we got a standing army and we got a central bank.
Think about douchebags, and I'm sorry for using that term, but think about historical douchebags that get little fucking musicals about him. He wanted Hamilton wanted to create a plantation. The Constitution's purpose was to turn our country into a giant plantation. And I look around and I say, fuck, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
It is a plantation in a lot of ways. Hey, we got about 10 minutes left, and I'd like to do a sort of an out-of-the-zone question, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
And I just got to say, I know sometimes, sometimes people don't always communicate in a way that people understand each other, but I really have enjoyed this so far. And like I said, if I kind of beat up on some of your people, it wasn't intentional, just so you know.
Okay.
What is the President Kokesh response? Assuming it's real, which means I don't care whether it's a bioweapon or the wrong bat met the wrong monkey, but what is a President Kokesh response to something like an epidemic?
Well, first of all, there is not really such a thing, because I resign on day one. I would not be president long enough to exercise presidential authority to do such a thing. One of the things that we have learned from the recent coronavirus case is that government can't be trusted to handle epidemics. And it's really sad, because we have invested so much trust and resources in the world to governments with the expectation that they're going to keep us safe from these kinds of things. And even in today's transparent world of the internet, of course, less transparent behind the Great Firewall of China, we see that the Chinese government has lied repeatedly about the reality of the coronavirus. We have seen even in the United States, where we have a flourishing internet that brings an incredible amount of transparency to the world, that the United States government is trying to get in on the fear-mongering and use this as an excuse to suggest that they might have to impose martial law, quarantine controls already in effect, as we see for people returning from China. And I'm not against the mechanisms that they're employing necessarily, as maybe this is the best we have today. But by localizing government as the first step to transitioning to a completely better system, we can at least get a lot of this dishonesty under control from government, especially when it comes to important things like the potentials for outbreaks that really do require a coordinated effort. What we're going to have in a voluntary society that would be a much more effective way of handling this, first of all, is a healthcare system that is transparent and accountable to customers. Right now, government having, I mean, we have socialized medicine in the United States. Let's be honest. Is it 100% socialized?
Dude, I worked in healthcare, both clinical and financial informatics and healthcare for many years. Mm. You don't need to tell me. It's very socialist, very crooked. That's correct.
Yes, yes. And I would say, you know, we have, you know, a hybrid socialist free market system in the United States. Obviously, it's not all one or the other, but there is never really an all one or all the other perfect system anyway until we get to a truly voluntary society. And there is not one aspect of medicine in the United States that is not corrupted by government's intervention. And it's really sick. You know, sometimes I think of being a libertarian as a curse, right? Like having the code to the matrix. You know, you don't see the code. You go blonde, brunette, redhead. Okay. You know, you just see statism everywhere and you go, wow. Yeah. Like, this is really holding us back, man. This really sucks. You know, and I have to remind myself to see the beauty in the world. And I don't have to remind myself. I'm more in that mode automatically, I guess. But yeah, that there is beauty and progress and so much growing and expanding love in the human experience. But yeah, when you see that behind everything, it really is scary. But then you have to be hopeful and understand that we're capable of something so much better. And it's not just the transition to a voluntary, more ethical society, but specifically as I would describe it in a sort of policy context, is that we get to localize government. We get to get it down to the community level where it's transparent, it's accountable, based on your values, set up to meet your needs. The eventual goal of a purely voluntary society is one of harmony, nonviolence, respect for individual rights. And when we get to that point, we're going to have systems that in some ways we probably can't even imagine today, based on, again, cooperation, based on real accountability and transparency, that are going to be able to deal with the potential of an outbreak much more effectively. And I think one of the most important mechanisms, and this is kind of a, you know, economics nerding out here to get into this, you know, future economic plan, but to see that financial liability, you know, it's financial liability sounds like kind of a nerdy policy term, but when you see, look, hey, when you take away financial liability, as in you trust a government that makes sure that its bureaucrats, liars, politicians, leaders, decision makers don't have financial liability for their decisions, that's how evil happens.
That's moral hazard. You know,
yeah, and just bringing financial liability back to its proper place in society. Just think of it as accountability. Are you accountable for your actions? Well, government protects people from accountability. Markets hold them accountable. I'm really excited that we are on the verge of what did they call it in China? A great leap forward. Yeah, let's just use that.
Do you know what that refers to, though? The great leap
forward. Yeah, No, I know. It's a disgusting communist term, but I think it's the words themselves.
And Chinese died, so.
Right. You know, yeah. Exactly. I'm downplaying it. I should be referring to it as genocide. But no, I think that term though really does describe that we are on the verge of a great leap forward of peace and progress and voluntarism. I think this is. You know, this acceleration of the human experience with technology happening before our eyes. It is a really exciting time to be alive.
You have a really positive attitude, Mr. Kokesh. I mean, you do, and I'm not saying that to be flippant. I just, you know, I think I didn't know what to expect.
You see, First, I mean, you get that view of the Matrix where you see the effects of violence and coercion everywhere, and it's like overwhelming. Oh my gosh, there's so much evil and injustice in the world. But I think I have gotten to the phase in my intellectual and, dare I say, spiritual development as a libertarian that I'm much more attuned to the beautiful underlying progress of humanity, the great dance forward, perhaps of two steps forward, one step backwards, but we are moving forward as a species. And when you see that we have come so far, you can't help but feel the expansion of love and want to just say, yeah, go team people. We're doing it. We're doing it. We're doing it. It's getting better every day. We are getting more free. And again, this is why it's so important to recognize that the measure of evil of government is not its size, but its violence, how much it coercively takes us away from our state of harmony. We're in a big step backwards right now of modern bureaucratic governments built around fiat currencies. But we're on the verge of two great steps forwards in this dance where they're accelerating. The steps get bigger with every generation. And what we are on the verge of now is not just rendering governments obsolete, but really embracing a higher level of consciousness, an evolved sense of awareness, a truly inclusive understanding of the whole human family, of deserving of individual rights and love and respect for freedom.
That sounds pretty good. Before we go, is there anything you'd like to let my listeners know about your campaign, any upcoming events or anything like that?
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, Dan. And before I get into that, I want to say thank you for this opportunity and for what you're doing in independent media with this podcast, because you know, I'm, as much as I'm a techno-optimist, the technology means nothing without deliberate conscientious use and overthrowing the grip of the mainstream media, supporting independent media. I want to tell your audience, if you're listening to this, if you got this far through the episode, please share it. And if you like Dan's production, support it. Share his main pages, put your money where your ears are, and be a part of this incredible dance forward of which independent media is a really critical component. So thank you, Dan, and to your audience for making this possible. Right now, we are about one third of the way through convention season, and delegates have been selected for about a third of the population of the U.S. within the Libertarian Party. That means two thirds are still open, and there are a lot of ways to get involved and to be supportive. Of course, we depend on donations rather than corporate bribes to get around the country here in No Force One to get things done, to keep the lights on for this campaign. You know, we have one person on staff, and we have an amazing team of volunteers. We need people who are willing to put in the work to step up. But right now, donations are especially welcome as we're zigzagging across the country and working to support our delegates. We have a lot of people who want to go to the national convention in Austin in May and simply can't afford it. And just to be able to support them would be really huge, to encourage that participation. If people want to donate, thefreedomline.com is my main website. It's easier than remembering how to spell my funny last name to get to kokeshforpresident.com. But you can donate crypto there, Bitcoin Cash, and we take all other forms of cryptocurrency with a little extra work. And I'm really happy to support cryptocurrency as a whole. If you can, the most important thing you can do to support us to help win the nomination is to be a delegate yourself to the national convention. It sounds like a big deal. It's really not. In fact, it's embarrassingly easy to get a spot as a national delegate with the Libertarian Party. So if you want to do that, please send me an email. My email address is adam@thefreedomline.com. If you're interested in being a delegate, please put that in the subject. Let us know why you're writing, and we'll make sure to prioritize that. Like I said, we've got Alabama and Iowa coming up this weekend, and then just zigzagging across the country, going to as many state conventions as we possibly can before the convention in May, when the Libertarian Party will decide its nominee and what message we want to put forward on the main stage. I will say we've got a lot of other great candidates in the race who would be more than capable standard bearers for this movement, for this cause, for this message. I am running because what I offer policy-wise is truly unique, and giving the American people the choice of a non-ideological based presidential candidate saying, look, you want this in your state, you're going to get more of what you want with this practical policy that immediately improves everyone's lives, and giving the American people the first real option that we've had since the revolution. So, again, thefreedomline.com, and thank you, Dan, and thank you to the audience for sticking with us.
And one last question before you go. Are you expecting sure. to is No Force One expecting to get anywhere near Washington State this year?
You know, it's funny. I wish it were, because I am going to be at the Washington State Convention. My family from the Seattle area are going to be there. It's in Issaquah. And same place it was last year at a Holiday Inn, really great venue for us. And my mom and my brother and a few other members of my family are looking to get seated as delegates representing Washington. But because the weekend before we're in, I think, D.C., and then the weekend after in Virginia, something like that, we're going to have to fly, my fiance and myself, we're going to be flying in and out of Seattle for the Washington Convention.
Oh, gotcha. Well, Mr.
Go ahead. See you there, Dan. I'd love to see you there, Dan. I know you said you're based in the Seattle area. The Washington State Convention is a little bit later in the season, so at least you haven't missed it yet. It is coming up. It is going to be March 28 and 29 at the Holiday Inn in Issaquah, Washington, and I would love to see you there. And anybody else who can come out to be supportive or to get plugged into the delegate process, it'd be great to have you.
Absolutely. It's like you convinced me to vote.
How about that?
Almost. Let's not wager on that yet, okay, Mr. Kokesh?
Well, you don't have to touch any of the government to be a part of the libertarian primary process.
True. Well, anyways, thanks again, Adam. I got to be honest with you. I don't know if I'm capable of voting, but if I do vote, it'll be for you. I can say that statement, okay?
Well, we definitely encourage defensive voting and to express a preference for not being beaten by government. I think the more we say that, every chance we get, the sooner this injustice is going to stop.
Absolutely. And for all my listeners, you know my position, but Mr. Kokesh makes an excellent point. So it, really, you need to consider it. If you did get chosen, I got to be honest, like I said, if you were chosen as a libertarian candidate, I think I would campaign and vote for you. I also think it's dangerous, as you know, for you, but I think you've accepted it. And so thanks again, and I wish you success, and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Dan. Peace and love, y'all.